Kamala Harris makes history as the first Black woman vice presidential nominee.
She noted that Black women have rallied, they have marched, they have fought for many of these movements that have led us to this point today.
I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, August 20th, a look at the first virtual Democratic National Convention. Also, how the Democratic Party is reaching Native American communities and Senator Harris's track record with tribal leaders.
I think as AG, I would say it's a fairly poor record, but she's obviously made some strides since then in trying to come around and work with tribal leaders.
Then, how sports fans have to grapple with their love of the teams and players and the ethical dilemma that sometimes comes with it.
I've had my own personal reckoning around the Seminoles mascot and my uncomfortableness with it, and what does that mean for me as a fan?
But first, the path to a historic vice presidential nomination.
I keep thinking about that 25-year-old Indian woman, all of 5 feet tall, who gave birth to me at Kaiser Hospital in Oakland, California. On that day, she probably could have never imagined that I would be standing before you now and speaking these words. I accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States of America.
Last night, Kamala Harris became the first Black and South Asian woman to accept the nomination for Vice President for a major political party. Black women have been an essential part of the Democratic Party for more than half a century. A recent Pew study found that 87% of Black women identified as Democrats, making them one of the most party-loyal demographics in the country. Yet they've often been sidelined, forced to fight for a seat at the table, and left off the pages of history. Some more numbers to consider. Only 47 Black women have ever served in Congress, and Kamala Harris is only the second Black woman to be a senator. But Black women have helped shape the ideology of the party and have played a central role in the lead-up to the 2020 election, when a record-breaking 122 Black women filed to run for congressional seats. Joining me now is Co Bragg, a reporter for the 19th, a nonprofit newsroom with a focus on gender policy and politics. Thank you for joining us, Co.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Kat Stafford, an Associated Press reporter on race and ethnicity. Hi, Kat.
Hi, how are you doing, Bridget?
I'm great. And Kat, I want to start with big picture. Black women are one of the most consistent voting demographics in the country, and this holds true across this diverse population. What drives the turnout?
Black women, when they head to the polls, when they usher their families, their friends, they know that they are not just voting for a simple reason. Many of these women believe they are voting for life or death for their communities. When you look at the legacy of Black women, Black people in this nation has a long history of racism. We are still dealing with the effects of slavery, and systemic racism still permeates through the fabric of this nation. So when Black women head to the polls, they head to the polls with that on their shoulders, with that on their minds. So when you have Kamala Harris reaching this new level for Black women within politics, it's quite an emotional moment for many of them.
And Kat, despite being faithful Democratic voters, how has the Democratic Party sidelined Black women?
So historically, Black women have been the ones who have organized. I believe Kamala Harris stated this in her acceptance speech. She noted the legacy of Black women, those who came before her. She noted that Black women have rallied, they have marched, they have fought for many of these movements that have led us to this point today, whether that was the civil rights movement or the fight for women to get the right to vote, which we know did not come into fruition for Black women until many, many years later. So when you talk about the legacy of Black women, they are the ones who have been the backbone of these struggles in America. And that in turn, though, has forced them to be on the sidelines because of racism, because of sexism, which in many cases, only women of color face that double-edged sword.
Co-Senator Harris is now one of the few examples of a Black woman in politics who actually has a seat at the highest table. What's the significance of this moment in terms of the leadership opportunity, but also the burden?
Yeah, so I think that Senator Harris got to this in her speech last night in talking about the multifacetedness of this moment. She was really specific about where she fits into the legacy of this nation by sharing a lot of parts of what made her her. She talked about Howard University. She talked about being a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated. And all of these things made her who she was since she was born at that hospital in Oakland. I think this was the first time for a lot of people that she was very, very specific in talking about who her family was, who she thought to be the people that have gotten her to this moment, whether they are alive to see her or not. And I think this is happening in the moment of a Democratic National Convention that is, they keep referring to as an unconventional convention because of this moment that we're, you know, facing this pandemic. And she was one of the only people to mention that the 19th Amendment, the centennial of which we're celebrating this week, did not successfully achieve access to the ballot for all. I think it is definitely a landmark, and it is something that my newsroom is named after, but with an asterisk, right, to denote the fact that not all people, not all women, got the right to vote following this amendment to the Constitution. And I think that's really important, and I think she knows that in this moment, as both Senator Harris and Michelle Obama have stated in their speeches, that they love their country. But I think when you hear the only Black woman in the U.S. Senate, and if she is elected to the White House, will leave that Senate without a Black woman there to, she talks about opening doors, being the first of many, but without someone else to take up that baton. I think that when she, especially Black women, say that they are fighting for equality and access in this country out of a love, that is also carrying a lot of what Kat was saying, the trauma and the legacy of what it means to fight for the ballot. And I think she did an excellent job of mentioning a lot of Black women who I hope people will learn about. Mary Church Terrell, Mary McLeod Bethune, Diane Nash, Fannie Lou Hamer.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Co, because, you know, I want to spend a moment talking about some of those women that Senator Harris mentioned last night. You know, Fannie Lou Hamer was a civil rights activist. Lots of our listeners will know her work well. But for those who don't, can you talk about her impact and influence on the Democratic Party?
Absolutely. So I have roots in Mississippi. And so Fannie Lou Hamer is iconic in so many ways. She was a farmer. She was a sharecropper. And she fought to push the party to where it needed to go, to push the party to see women like her who had carried this nation, who had built this nation, right? And yet could not be elected, did not have, this party did not make room. And so she founded the Freedom Democratic Party to really push the party where she wanted to see it go. And I think that that's really important to lift her name up in this moment, right? When, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer was fighting for food access for farmers in the Mississippi Delta, who, I mean, the irony is so burdening that, like, to be a farmer, to be a sharecropper, to be the descendant of the enslaved and yet be hungry. And we're now in this moment where so many people are facing hunger in this pandemic and racism and just so many dueling factors that make life really hard. I think to lift her name up is really important, and also a nod to the work that Senator Harris and Joe Biden will have to do to honor the fact that there are a lot of people who want to see the Democratic Party incorporate people further on the left, and incorporate those values and push them further. And the reality is there's a lot of criticism because of their records with the crime bill and Senator Harris coming from a law enforcement background. We're in the moment where we're still facing, you know, the ramifications of the uprisings we saw this summer, and people want to see more.
Kat, let's talk a moment about Shirley Chisholm, famously unbought and embossed. She was the first Black woman elected to the House and then ran for president in 1972. What effect did just seeing a Black woman run for president at that time have on future generations, including someone like Senator Harris?
I'm so glad you brought Shirley Chisholm, because I just had a story where I actually spoke with Hazel Deuce, who's this longtime activist, 88 years old, and she walked me through that moment of when she saw Shirley Chisholm get on that stage in 1972 in Miami. And for her and for so many Black women, it was more than just a historical moment. It was a moment of hope, a moment that they knew would open more doors, a moment that they knew that eventually would potentially lead to an opportunity for someone to come through like Kamala Harris. And that's really the legacy of Chisholm. That's the legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer. That's the legacy of all of these Black women who have come before Kamala Harris. And I just thought it was so poignant last night when she said that as Americans, we all stand on their shoulders. And that's true, because once again, Black women have been at the forefront of these fights for so long. It is just now that people have fully begun to realize their power and the strength that they bring with them to this table.
Kat, the pandemic overshadows everything about this election and this convention. And Senator Harris spoke to that last night, connecting it to the work we need to do to fight racism.
This virus, it has no eyes, and yet it knows exactly how we see each other and how we treat each other. And let's be clear, there is no vaccine for racism. We've got to do the work.
Yes, and look, we know through my reporting, through the reporting of so many others, that this pandemic has disproportionately impacted Black Americans and other people of color. They have been hit hard, really, by what I've been noting as three crises going on at the same time, which is the health implications of people dying, which is the economic fallout from the pandemic, people losing their jobs, unable to put food on the table for their families. But then you couple that with this moment that we're in, with this reckoning around racism in this country. And so you can't talk about any of this without noting that race is at the center of this election. Racism is at the center of this country. And I think what Senator Harris did last night was really make sure that we brought that to the forefront and recognize that in order for this nation to move forward, it's going to have to grapple with this long history of racism in this country. There's no other way forward.
If the Harris-Biden ticket is successful in November, as you mentioned, there will be no more Black women in the Senate. For both of you, why do we need more Black women leaders, and how would this country be different if that were a reality?
I think that the reality is that representation does matter. And regardless of how you feel about the representation, Black women deserve to be at every level represented for the work that they do. And that is very obvious in the Democratic Party. And I think that if Senator Harris makes it to the White House, that her absence will be felt. I think she brings her prosecutorial background whenever we see her at a hearing, and we will lose that. And it is a shame that in this historic moment where we are celebrating such a gain, that we have to always be thinking about what we're losing. There's always a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And I think that that will be underscored no matter what happens.
And for me, I think this is an important point. You know, I spoke with Dr. Jonetta Cole, who, of course, was the first Black woman president of the historical HBCU Bellman. And something that she said really stuck with me. She said, if you see one, you can be one. And I'm saying that because for every little Black girl in this country, for really every little girl in this country, when they see someone like Senator Harris, when they see someone like Stacey Abrams, it just lets them know that they too can do that. But everything that Koja said, I agree with her, because while this is a moment of celebration, we can't fully declare that it's a victory, because America has yet to see its first Black woman governor. And it's 2020. Think about that and let that sink in. We still have so much more work to do.
Ko Bragg is a reporter for the 19th, and Kat Stafford is an Associated Press reporter on race and ethnicity. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Donald Trump hasn't grown into the job because he can't. And the consequences of that failure are severe. 170,000 Americans dead. Millions of jobs gone. While those at the top taken more than ever. Our worst impulses unleashed, our proud reputation around the world badly diminished, and our democratic institutions threatened like never before.
Last night, President Barack Obama delivered a searing takedown of the current president as part of the third night of the Democratic Party's virtual convention. Until now, the former president and first lady have declined to take an active role in the campaign, but their speeches this week about the state of the country were impassioned and urgent. Vice presidential nominee Senator Kamala Harris capped off Wednesday night's programming, drawing on her experiences as the child of immigrants and echoing warnings about the stakes of the upcoming election. For more on last night and highlights from the last 3 days of the convention, let's go to my colleague Amy Walter, the host of Politics with Amy Walter, here on The Takeaway every Friday, and national editor of the Cook Political Report. Welcome, Amy.
Hey, Bridget, how are you?
I'm great. So a lot has happened so far. What were your main takeaways from last night?
Yeah, you're right to highlight the President Obama clip there. I mean, this was supposed to be the night for the vice presidential nominee. And of course, she did get the closing speech. But it really was, if we look at what is going to be remembered about last night, it will be the president, the former president's speech. Basically a warning that we've been hearing from other speakers throughout this week about what's at stake in this election. But when it comes from the former president of the United States standing in front of the Constitution in Philadelphia and saying there's nothing less than basically the fate of democracy on the ballot, that's a pretty powerful statement that is not easily going to be overshadowed.
Issues of immigration and climate change and gun violence also played a real central role in last night's broadcast, perhaps even more so than during the primary debates. Why do you think that was?
Yeah, so I think the first 2 days of this convention were about making people comfortable with Joe Biden, sort of filling in the gaps of who Joe Biden is as a person. Obviously, the person who did that best and who is usually the best person to tell us the story of the person who's going to want to be president of the United States is their spouse. And so that was the Jill Biden story the other night. They were also trying to, these first 2 days, to make voters comfortable with Joe Biden, who voters who traditionally have not been strong Democratic supporters. Maybe they're not ideologically aligned with Democrats. Maybe they sat on the sidelines in 2016. Maybe they voted for a third party candidate last time. Maybe they supported Trump in 2016, but voted for a Democrat in 2018. Many of these are those suburban white voters who have been soured on Donald Trump, but need to be reassured that Joe Biden is not going to be too far left, that he's not going to embrace some of the ideological causes that we've seen from other members of the Democratic Party, which is why we saw people like Colin Powell, former Republican Governor John Kasich, and then, of course, Cindy McCain, the widow of John McCain, talking about the friendship between John McCain and Joe Biden. Last night was really a night for the base. Here are the issues that motivate Democratic voters, especially younger voters: climate and guns and immigration.
Another prominent theme, though, was children. And earlier in the convention, we saw Dr. Jill Biden deliver her speech from a high school classroom. Last night, Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke from a childhood education center. Here's part of what she said.
It's time to recognize that childcare is part of the basic infrastructure of this nation. It's infrastructure for families. Joe and Kamala will make high-quality childcare affordable for every family.
What are speakers trying to telegraph with those backdrops? And to your point about who this convention is appealing to, who are they speaking to there?
I also thought it was really important to note that they were speaking from empty classrooms. And I think for so many parents, that is such a powerful reminder of how much our lives have been upended in these past few months. This idea that something is as normal as going back to school, which is what we normally would be talking about this time of year, is now considered radical. The thought that your child will be able to do full-time schooling at all this year, if not even just potentially going a couple days a week. So I thought that that was a very powerful decision to put both of those speakers in empty classrooms as a reminder of how important being a leader is in terms of getting our lives back to normal. And then when you talk about school and child care, also speaking again to the many women voters who make up the core, the sort of the backbone of the Democratic Party. But once again, speaking to maybe some of those disaffected independent voters, many of whom could have voted for Donald Trump last time, or maybe think that Joe Biden's not the right person for them. That is another group of people that I think this was aimed at.
Tonight's the final day of the Democratic Convention, where we will finally hear from Joe Biden himself. What are you going to be watching for tonight?
It's really, a lot of it is just simply his delivery, explaining who he is, why he wants to be president, and what he's going to do as president. And more important, as I said about the delivery, is how he looks. One of the biggest attacks that Donald Trump has on Joe Biden is that he simply doesn't have the stamina or mental acuity for this job. He needs to be able to push back on that simply by how he delivers the speech.
Amy, can you give us a preview of what Takeaway listeners can expect to hear on your show tomorrow?
Sure. We are going to break down this week's convention and, of course, focus on the speech that Joe Biden will be giving tonight. And we're also doing another episode in our series of campaigning in a time of COVID and checking in on how organizers are able to meet with voters even in the middle of a pandemic.
Amy Walter is host of Politics with Amy Walter here on The Takeaway every Friday and national editor of the Cook Political Report. Thank you, Amy.
You're very welcome. It's great to be with you.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This week, during the roll call of the Democratic National Convention, a record number of Native Americans were featured. In the lead-up to the November elections, we're looking at different aspects of Harris and Biden's records and plans. Today, we turn to their stances on tribal nations and ask how the campaign and the Democratic Party is working with tribal leaders. Ryan Ramirez is chair of the Democratic National Committee's Native American Caucus and an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians. I asked him about his work with the Obama administration.
So under President Obama, I was in 2007, 2008, part of a small group that helped write his platform for Indian Country in terms of his policy piece for Indian Country, and helped in that regard. That was the first time in history that we ever had a candidate really try to engage the Native American vote, and most in particular, you know, he was very, very thoughtful about including Indian Country when he spoke. Just the fact of including us in his overall vision for the United States was something that we had never seen before. President Obama was by far the greatest president in history of the United States in terms of his record in dealing with Indian Country.
Do you think his administration could have done a better job handling protests at the Dakota Access Pipeline and Standing Rock?
Yeah, I mean, so everybody, you know, I think would say yes in that regard. That is something that's incredibly important in terms of meaningful consultation in terms of Indian Country. Ultimately, they got to the right point in terms of denying the permit for that, and the Trump administration came in shortly thereafter and reversed course in that regard. But I would say, you know, they could have done a better job of engaging and consulting with the tribal government in terms of the impacts of the pipeline.
We're living amid a global pandemic, and we have to consider the impact of health disparities. And I'm wondering if this has underscored the need for specific funding commitments from the federal government to tribal nations.
Yeah, I would say 100% yes. So, you know, everything associated with COVID is hitting extremely hard in terms of Indian country. I mean, in terms of the COVID-19 situation and the bills that are working their way through Congress, there is always more to be done. And the more that they can do to live up to their treaty and trust responsibilities, the better off we're going to be.
Ryan, let's turn to this year's Democratic platform. Are there specific parts of it aimed at addressing the needs of tribal nations?
Yes, most definitely. I think one of the things I'm most proud of is the great work that Representative Deb Haaland did associated with the platform committee. So she was our representative in terms of the Native American on the drafting committee. She led that work. Myself and others were serving on the platform committee, and what's included in that platform, I think, is incredibly historic. You know, for the first time ever, it includes a land acknowledgement, recognizing and honoring the Native communities on this continent, and recognizing the fact that our country was built on Indigenous homelands, and goes through and respectfully acknowledges the tribes within Wisconsin, because that was the place we were going to host our Democratic convention. It also includes within the platform, you know, a commitment to fully fund those treaty and trust obligations that I was talking about previously, fully fund IHS, enact a clean carcerary fix. So I think it's profoundly progressive and something I'm incredibly proud of as a Democrat.
Ryan Ramirez is chair of the Democratic National Committee's Native American Caucus and an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians. Thank you so much, Ryan.
Thank you.
We continue this conversation now with Nick Martin, staff writer for the New Republic and member of the Saponi tribe. I asked him for his take on the last administration.
I think what you saw with the Obama administration was an administration in both terms that understood that its relationship with tribal nations is truly a nation-to-nation relationship. And so what you had was the big part, I think, especially for tribal leaders, was the annual summit the Obama administration would have, in which they would bring in tribal leaders as well as members of the cabinet and, you know, the president himself, and they would have a day or so of conversations and just kind of discussing the most pressing issues in Indian country with the tribal leaders on its own, in addition to all the other good work the Obama administration did. That was a departure from past administrations, and honestly from probably every administration ever, because what the United States has kind of committed a longstanding failure of is to recognize tribal nations as sovereign entities.
Were there some policy areas where President Obama was less well-received by Native communities?
I mean, I think the big thing that's easiest to point to there would be the kind of side effects of his kind of ramping up of domestic energy production, because a lot of that kind of runs into a lot of these oil and mining projects. They oftentimes run alongside or directly into tribal lands or ancestral tribal lands. And a lot of times, even though that consultation process is still in place, it's not necessarily adhered to. And we've had lots of government accountability reports that showed that even under the Obama administration, and now especially under the Trump administration, you know, these kind of extractive industries have just not really dealt with tribal nations as sovereign entities. Mm-hmm. And so, like, Standing Rock is the big kind of, I think, flashpoint that kind of shows that even under a president like Obama, who had an open ear, who actively campaigned in Indian country, that there was still room to grow just in terms of listening and respecting people's, you know, people's wishes, but also just, you know, tribal boundaries and things of that nature.
What has been the Trump administration's communication with tribal nation leaders compared to what we saw under President Obama?
I mean, it's been little to none. I mean, essentially, you still have operations like the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Department of Interior trying to, you know, still work with tribal nations. But when you've also got the Interior and the Bureau of Land Management trying to actively work against tribal nations in terms of protecting and stewarding their homelands. When you've got a border wall cutting through multiple tribal nations, kind of sacred and ancestral burial grounds, you're just not fostering a positive relationship. And I think a lot of that has to just do with the fact that I think it's fair to question at this point, openly criticize the Trump administration for not having any sort of desire to engage with Indian country on even close to the level that the Obama administration did. It's been a complete departure. Whenever I've spoken with tribal leaders, it's kind of been night and day. And so I think that, anything that gets them back to that status quo established under the Obama administration is obviously going to be, a welcome change.
Let's turn for a moment to the current Democratic ticket, starting with the vice presidential nominee. As Attorney General of California, Kamala Harris opposed a number of tribal land trust applications. What was her overall record with tribal nations as Attorney General?
I think would probably lean towards somewhat negative just because of I think in total it was 15 blocked applications. And then she also tried to minimize or diminish a tribal reservations in Southern California. So, all of that is kind of a direct blow against what are kind of the basic tenets of Indian law and the pursuit of tribal sovereignty, as I've kind of been going on about here. But I think as AG, I would say it's a fairly poor record, but she's obviously made, I think, some strides since then in trying to come around and, work with tribal leaders to, both as a presidential candidate and now as vice presidential candidate to try and, maybe not exactly right those wrongs. I wouldn't say she's been quite apologetic about that. She's mainly cited that she was doing the work of then California Governor Jerry Brown, which, I think is open to debate about whether, how one uses one's position of power and privilege. But I think in general, she has made a lot of strides and is actively trying to be a better partner.
Compared to Harris, what has Joe Biden's campaign done in terms of policy and outreach to Native communities?
So the Biden campaign they've been hiring up a lot. They hired a tribal engagement director recently and have kind of been staffing up as of late to make a push and to show that they've had open arms for Indian country. Now, I'll balance that out by saying that they didn't go to the initial Native American presidential forum that most of the major candidates went to last August. And they were among the last of the major presidential Democratic candidates to release a policy plan for Indian country. Now, in the time since, I know he's promised mandatory funding for the Indian Health Service. He is one of the original champions of the Violence Against Women Act, which as of 2013 has added measures to allow tribes to enforce some jurisdictional issues that had previously left victims of domestic abuse in a tough spot. I know that he has also kind of pledged to create a Veterans Affairs Tribal Advisory Committee to help with the delivery of programs to Native veterans. So, all of that on its own are good things. I think that, they're trying to maybe make up a little ground for being slow to the roll on this. But, like I said, the same with Harris, where they recognize that not just like as a moral obligation that they should be reaching out to Indian country and including them in their tent, but also they recognize that like in a lot of states, the Native vote is fairly significant. And if you want to kind of energize those voters, you have to go beyond campaign promises to vaguely be good. And you have to show them actual concrete policies that they will enact if he is elected president to really kind of get these voters out in swing states where he's going to need them most.
Nick Martin is a staff writer for the New Republic and member of the Saponi tribe. Thanks for joining us, Nick.
Thanks again for having me.
For many people of color, there's a long history of exclusion from places of outdoor recreation, big and small, whether it's the rapids winding through the Grand Canyon or a garden at your neighborhood park. All week, the takeaway has been looking at past and present access to national parks in the U.S. And so we wanted to ask you, our listeners, about your experiences with the outdoors as people of color, and whether or not you camped, hiked, biked, or climbed in outdoor spaces near and far.
Hi, this is Denise in Brooklyn, New York. I grew up in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, and I didn't have any experience going to the outdoors with my family because my parents were both working all the time. And I don't think they even knew about national parks. And I guess we didn't need to since we lived on the beach. But I still think my parents don't know about national parks. It just wasn't a thing people knew about in Brighton Beach.
My name is Tony Barnes from Detroit, Michigan. My father was a truck driver in Michigan. When they opened a new national park, our family was the first ones there. In addition, he took us to Pointe-Pilly in Canada. In 1968, my parents bought a cottage up north at Shea Lake in Pensacola County, and we spent the summers up there, water skiing, cookouts, and dances. My six siblings and I had a glorious childhood.
This is Hector in Spokane, Washington. We never camped as a kid. Our parents were always working and never had time or extra money to take time off to take us camping or going outdoors. Our primary language was Spanish, and there isn't much outreach to the Spanish community to get people outdoors.
This is Melissa Freyer from Mill Valley, California. For me, we were not outdoorsy at all. My parents were refugees, and it both wasn't part of their culture growing up, and they couldn't understand why we kids would want to sleep in the woods when we had a perfectly nice and safe bed at home. I didn't go on a real hike until after law school, really. Proud to say I've since gotten really comfortable in the outdoors and even completed some ultra marathons. It's really nice to discover these places as an adult.
Keisha, St. Pete, Florida. Being from the islands, we went outside every day, and we would go to the country during the summer. Our grandparents would tell us, if you're hungry, it's your fault, because there's food everywhere. You have to go out and forage for it.
My name is Louise. I'm calling from Pasadena, California. I was born in 1955 as a Negro in the segregated South Side of Chicago to a two-parents household of poor people. I was 7 of 9 children. In the summer, my family let us out to play after breakfast. We had to be home for lunch, and then we ran freely until dinner time. We really enjoyed the great outdoors in that way.
Hi, my name is Cree. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. My father was in the military, and we moved every 3 years, but we were really lucky to have been stationed in Japan. And as a Girl Scout there, we hiked up Mount Fuji, amongst other outings. We were also stationed in California twice, and Yosemite National Park was really nearby, so we visited there often, camping out, etc. I've come to find that a lot of African-American children did not get to have these wonderful experiences growing up, so I am really, really grateful to have had these opportunities.
What about you? What was your experience with the outdoors growing up as a person of color? Tell us about it by calling 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Professional sports have looked very different over the last few months. We've been bringing you a lot of stories about the challenges that COVID-19 has posed for entire sports ecosystems, from players and organizations to fans and communities. I, for one, really miss normal summer baseball, which for my family usually means cheering on the New York Yankees with actual people in the stands. But well before COVID, many of us were already wrestling with the reality of loving a sport and hating some of what goes on off the field or the court.
As a fellow Yankees fan, I think we've probably faced some similar quandaries.
That's Kavitha Davidson, co-author of the forthcoming Loving Sports When They Don't Love You Back, Dilemmas of the Modern Fan. In the book, she and co-author Jessica Luther take on the ethical challenges of being a sports fan today. I asked them about what issues they wanted to tackle.
You know, the biggest one I think that I'm confronted with almost constantly is when you love a team or a player that has been accused of violence against women. And that's something as Yankee fans that we have in Aroldis Chapman, our closer. One of the things that also just growing up in Washington Heights in northern Manhattan and not really being able to afford to go to Yankee games, but going on class trips is you see what the neighborhoods that these stadiums are in are like, and that, you know, the promise of economic development doesn't actually bear any fruit. So the stadium subsidies chapter, where we explore how these stadiums take taxpayer dollars and don't actually give anything back to the neighborhoods that they're in, that's also something that I'm confronted with daily. And then the owners chapter as well, when you love your team but you hate your owner, again, as a native New Yorker and a Knicks fan, that resonates very strongly with me. But I think that there are lots of reasons that your owner might not necessarily reflect the fans. And that's something that is quite universal, I think, in sports fandom. So, you know, there are so many of these issues that we cover in the book, but those are three big ones to me that resonate as a New York sports fan.
And Jessica, what about you?
Yeah, so I have similar issues around gendered violence in sport, but I think we have a chapter on being a fan of women's sports and how you often feel like you're the only one. And that definitely rings true. Sometimes it's just really hard to be a women's sports fan because you don't have all the resources. It's not kind of like osmosis in the air. I always seem to know what's going on with the NBA, even if I don't care about it. But it's a lot harder when you're a women's sports fan. And the other big one for me is there's a chapter on racist native mascots. And I went to Florida State University, which is the Seminoles, and I've had my own personal reckoning around their mascot and my uncomfortableness with it. And what does that mean for me as a fan and an alumni of this institution that I love a lot? So that one is something that I've been thinking a lot about.
Jessica, even when some professional sports leagues face criticism, it seems like men still tend to be the face of the issue and at the center of research surrounding the issue. How did you see that play out in terms of what you learned about research for concussions in sports?
Yeah, we have a whole chapter on brain trauma in sport. And I think brain trauma is interesting in the fact that we tend to only really talk about it around the NFL, which of course is men and male athletes. But when you talk to experts on this, of course, girls and women are facing the same kind of issues, right? Cycling is actually the most dangerous sport for brain trauma. And lots of people do that in the world, you know, heading a soccer ball. There's all kinds of things where girls are just as, or and women are just as likely to get brain trauma, but so much of the work around it is on men's bodies. And we focus on sports, but these are issues that are bigger in the world, right? And brain trauma is one of those things. There's three groups that get it in large numbers, and those were athletes, football players, soldiers, and domestic violence victims. And within the larger society, the people we do research on are still mainly men, even though most domestic violence victims are women. So this is something about sports, but also bigger than that.
When we talk about an issue of representation in sports, Kavitha, when you think about the LGBTQ community, who do you feel like has been left out of those conversations?
I mean, definitely women. How many times do we see a piece or hear a television spot where, you know, the question is, when will we finally have an out active gay athlete? And you're just ignoring a huge chunk of the WNBA. You're ignoring Megan Rapinoe and Sue Bird and women's players who have reached the highest levels of their sport, by the way, who have always kind of had this courage and this bravery to be out and active. But I think that speaks to not only that it kind of takes men to be the face of these issues, but especially when it comes to an LGBTQ plus issue, it speaks to what we expect out of women's athletes, right? There's this idea of masculinity versus femininity, and femininity is the reason that women can't be proper athletes. So if they're gay, obviously they kind of buck that trend. That's kind of the thinking behind that. But it really is just unfair to the work that these women have done and continue to do, the work that women fans, that gay WNBA fans have done in this space space to try and push through and say, hey, you know, we're here, we have money to spend on these sports, pay some attention to us. You know, when we do finally have an out active male gay athlete, it's going to be because of the work that these women have done before them.
This summer, we've seen some shifts in terms of how pro sports leagues talk about racism and what they allow their players to say. Are you both seeing leagues make commitments to real change?
Yeah, I think it's actually been really stunning. And, you know, I come from a sports business reporting background, so I always kind of follow the money. And there's a lot of conversation right now, the same as we had when Colin Kaepernick first took his knee, about whether fans are going to stop watching the NBA because of its commitment to Black Lives Matter messaging and because fans don't want to be hit over the head with racial justice messaging. And the fact of the matter is, those fans might exist. I think they're few and far between, frankly, because I think a lot of people talk a big game, but when it comes at the end of the day, they don't actually turn the television off because of these things. But more importantly, the sponsors and the advertisers have decided that it is good business to support Black Lives Matter. Nike is putting out these incredibly moving spots. And Nike is problematic for all kinds of reasons. But, you know, the fact that you have these giant corporations that, with the leagues in partnership, are supporting these messages, this messaging does kind of go to show you where we are as a country right now. And it's not just the NBA, it's not just the NFL, which are majority Black player leagues. You're seeing this out of NASCAR. You're seeing this out of MLB. And it's really been stunning to see how this has spread so quickly and also that it kind of took this long.
Jessica, has there anything that has surprised you about some of these changes this summer from these leagues?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest was the Washington NFL team name, which for decades, Native and Indigenous people have been asking for them to change that name. It's a historically racist name that has been used in really terrible ways against Native people. And here we are all of a sudden, and they have finally changed the name. I mean, the owner of the team, Dan Snyder, who shows up in our owners chapter, you know, he said a few years ago he would never change it. And I talked to a couple of Native women who were part of this fight. And one of the things they pointed out was, you know, yes, it's been decades of Native and Indigenous people advocating for this, but Black Lives Matter really helped that momentum, and it built. And so it really did take this particular moment. Kavitha brought up, you know, corporations, you know, FedEx was not, they saw the writing on the wall when it came to the Washington NFL team's name, and that played a big role in that change. So, I mean, that's a tangible thing that has happened. I don't want to give the team a lot of credit for that because they should have done it a long time ago, but it is a big deal. And I was happy to see it. If people read the book, they'll see that we weren't sure that was ever going to happen. So that part of it matters a lot.
Jessica Luther and Kavitha Davidson are the co-authors of Loving Sports When They Don't Love You Back. Kavitha is also the host of the Athletics podcast, The Lead. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for us today. To our listeners and guests, thank you for taking this ride with me, and thank you for sharing your thoughts and stories. We value all of them. I can't say enough about how great the team is who puts the show together this week. Our board operators are Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry. Vince Fairchild was our director and sound designer. Line producing was Jackie Martin. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. And her crew is Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Lydia McMullen-Laird, and Asher Stockler. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. David Gable is our executive assistant. And Lee Hill is the executive producer of The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Amy Walter is with you on Friday, and Tanzina is back on Monday. I'm Bridget Bergen, and this is The Takeaway.